Thank you for tuning in to Not Suitable for Anyone. As a reminder, if you'd like to financially support the show, don't! Just help other people find us by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, or just telling a friend. If you do want to put your hard-earned dollars to work to support our mission, here's what you can do. Buy or rent movies. Redbox, iTunes, Vudu, it doesn't matter, hell, even an old-fashioned Blu-ray. Leave a review on Letterboxd or Amazon and tell them that you heard about it right here on
Not Suitable for Anyone.
Hey everybody, and thanks for tuning in. It's episode 36 of Not Suitable for Anyone, and as always, I'm your host, Patrick Anderson. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for checking it out. I am excited about today's show because I've lined up another really interesting guest. He was the writer-director of the short that we talked about last month, Snake Dick. I also have an update on our question, do snakes have dicks? But you're going to have to wait and wait around for the final segment to get the details on that particular question. So don't go anywhere, because I know you're not going to want to miss that, but also because I've got some cool new projects here lined up to talk about this week, and I don't want you to miss it. I have another short that I want to introduce. This one has not really gotten a lot of attention. It just checked it. It has around 200 views on YouTube, and that's a shame, because it's really, really good. And it's quality. I'm going to reach out to the directors and see if I can find out more about what they're doing, and maybe update you down the road. Also saw a recent movie. It was a late 2020 release that just hit Amazon Prime not too long ago. So I'm going to get into that a little bit. And then I have a crowdfunding project that is not necessarily flying below the radar, but still wanted to kind of highlight and talk about it, because it's a big one, and it's really interesting. And I think it's because of smaller budget indie efforts that it's even, being possible. So, I think those were words that I said. Anyway, but before we can get to those, and before we can get to our main topic, Snake Dick, I want to kick things off with a short that is relatively new. It's called Silent Shadow, and it says it is based on The Last of Us 2. Now, I don't know a goddamn thing about The Last of Us. I'm not a gamer. It's just not something that I do. It's not something, as a result, that I know a whole lot about. But I am aware of at least, some of the major happenings, and I know that The Last of Us was a big game that everybody liked. Last of Us 2 came out, and I understand that maybe it was a bit divisive, but nevertheless, it inspired this short, which, and again, I tried to do some research, so I apologize in advance. The directors on this short are, I believe it's pronounced Yolit Rios and Gary J. The location on the YouTube link says Detroit, and it definitely does look like something that was shot maybe in the woods in the southern or southeastern Michigan area. Maybe not. Could have been filmed almost anywhere. It's a pretty simple short film, and it's not very long. It's about 3.5 minutes long. I will put the link in the show notes, but you can find it on YouTube, again, under the name Silent Shadow. And I absolutely do think that you should go and check it out. But just to kind of give a brief synopsis of a 3-minute short film. It starts out with our main character in the woods, behind a tree, and then there are two other guys that enter the frame in the background that are clearly looking for her. So in a single shot, we see her sort of panicky, you know, putting her her bag back together because she knows that they're after her, and you know, so she knows that she's got to get the fuck out. So we have a quick cut and an action sequence as one of the assailants swings his bat at her, and she ducks just in time and then leads him on a chase through the woods. The music is good. It seems like they took a pre-existing score and just matched it to their shot, because it doesn't look like there was, you know, really any budget to speak of for this. So like I said, she leads one of the guys on a chase through the woods. And ducks down and readies her bow and arrow. And then this leads to kind of the money shot of the short, because she moves out to take a firing position, and then the sound kind of drops out. We get a focus on the arrow and a rack focus to our victim, and he takes an arrow right to the chest. It's really well edited. You know, it looks legit. Not much budget for effects, so we don't get, you know, big sprays and splashes of gore, but you get enough with the sound design and the editing to really sell it, that she has taken one of these guys out, and now she's gonna circle back for the other one. And this sort of leads to kind of a pretty awesome, you know, sort of stinger ending for the short, which I love, because she corners the second guy, and she thinks that she's got the upper hand on him. And instead, he lets out a whistle. And you hear other whistles off in the distance, and you realize that she's surrounded, and she might very well be fucked. And smash cut to black. So that's it. It's simple. It's really short, but effective. And really well made on what doesn't look like really much of a budget or much of a crew at all. You have three actors and three crew members. Two of the crew member names are also the credited as the co-directors. So this is really, you know, sort of a, you know, the kind of thing I really love, sort of that labor of love that's really exciting. So that's Silent Shadow. Like I said, go check it out. It's on YouTube. You know, bump up those viewership numbers. Drop them some likes and show them some love, because it's really well put together. So that's Silent Shadow. And next, I want to talk about a feature that I just saw for the first time in the past week. You can watch it on Amazon Prime. You can watch it on Vudu with ads, or you can rent or buy it on, you know, all the, you know, usual places: Amazon, Apple TV, etc. It's called Beast Mode, and it came out late 2020. I think around December was the release for it, but it's been around, floating around in festivals and things like that for several years. This is an interesting movie. It's kind of like Bowfinger meets Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type story. And I know those, you would think that those two things don't really go together, and you'd be right. They really don't. The main sort of basic premise is about this this sort of past his prime Hollywood producer who is sort of barely hanging on, and he's got this one final movie star that will work with him, and, you know, he's really in demand, and he backs over him with his car. So you do what you would do in that situation. After one, you know, sort of quick Weekend at Bernie's scene, he then tracks down a lookalike and basically decides that he's going to hire this lookalike actor to be the actual actor to be in the film. So I don't know if you've ever seen Bowfinger, but that's, you know, one of the part of the premise of Bowfinger is that Steve Martin can't get Eddie Murphy to be in his movie, so he gets this actor who looks like Eddie Murphy and tries to convince everyone that it's Eddie Murphy. It's not Eddie Murphy in the movie, obviously, but you know what I mean. And so it kind of starts out this really sort of farcical, lighthearted kind of thing.
How would you like to be a rich and famous actor for the rest of your life?
Am I going to be in an actual movie?
You're going to be playing famous Hollywood actor Huckle Saxton.
Huck's dead.
So we use a double. You're going to need to look like him, talk like him, walk like him, and treat others exactly the way he does.
It's a lot of pressure to be an entirely different person.
Don't you have some kind of a magic makeup?
So, yeah, you're thinking, all right, why are you talking about this? Because this doesn't sound like horror at all, and that's not where the horror comes from. This movie suddenly takes a wild left turn in terms of story, in that the producer asks for some makeup because their lookalike looks like the actor, because he's played by the same actor, but he has some scars and an aging that they're trying to reverse. So they need this special magic makeup, which turns out to be voodoo makeup, which leads to the other elephant in the room.
Don't you have some kind of a magic makeup?
We came across this cream. Wow, what is this?
It makes scars disappear. Wrinkles vanish.
It's got these amazing healing properties. I just want to tell you to get ready for a change. The new me is going to be different than the old me.
What is inside will be outside. And what is underneath will be revealed.
What did you get into last night?
So, yeah. The makeup is evil. It's made by voodoo or some shit. And it turns people into monsters at midnight, and they run around and kill people and drink their blood and eat their faces off. Yeah, that's the movie, folks. That's it. That's Beast Mode. And it's called Beast Mode because the movie that the producer is making is called Beast Moon, I guess, and that's why it's called Beast Mode. Really fascinating. It's got actually an interesting cast. The movie producers, or the main character, is C. Thomas Howell. He, I guess, was in a recent episode of Creepshow, which I didn't know. But you might remember him from all the way back in The Hitcher. So C. Thomas Howell is sort of the main character, and he's good. He plays a really, you know, awful, smarmy kind of Hollywood producer type guy. The actor, both the big movie star actor and the lookalike actor, are played by James Duvall, who you probably would recognize him most as Frank the Bunny from Donnie Darko. That guy's actually had quite a career. James Hong shows up for a little bit, and does his typical James Hong shtick. You know, I mean, he's a character actor. He plays himself. That's what he does. And Ray Wise shows up, looks like he was on set for, you know, all of a day. So there are some faces in here that you'll recognize. Most of them aren't in it for that long, except for James Duvall and C. Thomas Howell. The thing I find strange about this is, if they wanted to sort of have this monster movie idea, like, I don't understand why we needed the whole thing with the lookalike and getting the makeup. Like, why wouldn't you just run over your actor and then use some cream to, like, revive your actor, or some kind of, you know, reanimator serum or something? And, oh, it has this side effect of it also turns him into, you know, the Wolfman or whatever. I don't know. I don't quite get it, but that the movie's doing a lot, and it's blending a lot of things that are maybe not blendable. But that's Beast Mode. It is not very well received at all. It has a 3.7 on the IMDb. It's not particularly well liked, but I found it kind of fun and entertaining. And pretty over top and ridiculous, and this sort of this idea of James Duvall as an A-list Hollywood, you know, celebrity, like Charlie Sheen type celebrity, is kind of hilarious. The directors are Chris Freeman and Spain Willingham. Not really sure I can point you to anything that I personally have seen that you might know them from. Yeah, it's you know, for a movie that didn't cost me anything, you kind of throw on in the background and have a good time with, you know, Beast Mode. It's kind of silly and kind of weird. So yeah, I don't know. Check it out. Let me know what you think. And then our crowdfunding project. I wanted to plug a quick Kickstarter. First of all, update. Crowdfunding update. On the previous episode, I plugged an Indiegogo project called Living After Midnight. That project is funded. It's Brant Lewis. So congratulations to Brant. I'm excited to see how that short turns out. Go back, I don't know, a couple episodes and check that out if you want to know more about what that is. But it's an LGBT vampire romance thing. Sounds awesome. And I can't wait to see it. So hooray for Brant. Congratulations, and you know, my track record on this podcast is still intact. Every crowdfunding project that I have plugged and pitched on this show has been funded, so that's exciting. I'm going to put that record on the line right now, because this project that I want to talk about today has a really ambitious goal. They're looking for over 200 grand. And they are well under halfway there at the moment, but they have raised $84,000 from over 1,000 backers. There's 23 days left to go. It is a brand new real-time horror game called Ghosts, and it's being created by Jed Shepard, who was one of the writers and producers on Host, the 2020 pandemic film on Shudder that kind of took the world by storm. So Jed Shepard was part of that team that made Host. He is now partnering with Visible Games and Limited Run Games to create this full motion video horror game called Ghosts.
Ghosts is the first real-time live-action horror video game. There won't be any floating words or glowing doors to help you decide which way to go next. You're really there. It's your job to keep us alive when all around is trying to kill us. It's your job to help us survive the night.
The other interesting hook is that it is a live game, so it's only going to work at 10 p.m. Wherever your local time zone is. So when you're playing, everyone else is playing at the exact same time. And I guess if you lose, if you turn it off or whatever, you die. Or maybe everybody dies. I don't really know. Like I said earlier, I don't do games. But this sounds really cool. And it's getting a lot of attention already, in part because Jed Shepard was involved with Host and, you know, gained some popularity and notoriety that way. But I still wanted to talk about it because I don't know that this opportunity would exist if not for Host, which is definitely the kind of, you know, spirit of this podcast. You know, even though we didn't cover it here, because there were plenty of podcasts and plenty of people last year talking about Host, and, you know, sidebar, if you have not seen Host, stop what you're doing and go fucking watch Host, because it's awesome. Getting back to what I was saying, you know, That project was really kind of in the spirit of this, because it was, you know, it was no budget. It was, you know, just people coming together and wanting to create something, you know, unique, and something that was uniquely theirs. And they did it, and it was fantastic. And so now, you know, they're kind of, you know, to kind of cash in on this, I think is fantastic. And to sort of leverage that, you know, that notoriety into, you know, trying to create this game and do something else that's new and creative that nobody's ever done before, I think is really cool. So it's on Kickstarter. The link will be in the show notes, as always, but it's called Ghosts, real-time FMV horror game by Jed Shepard. You know, go look it up and go check it out, and, you know, and toss a few bucks their way, because it looks pretty amazing. So now I'm going to take a quick break, and I need to go and get David Mahmoudier on the line. So when I come back, I'm going to have David on, and We're going to talk about snake dick, and we will finally answer the question that I asked last week, do snakes have dicks, right here on Not Suitable for Anyone. So stay tuned.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound great.
Well, thanks for having me on, and I'm really glad that you like the short, and I checked out some of your other episodes, and they all sound really fun, and, you know, a lot of cool people you spoke to, so I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome, thanks, yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I love the short, man. I thought it was great. I think I saw the Instagram account.
Oh, nice, awesome. Yeah, no, it's been interesting because we were hoping to release it last year, and then obviously with the pandemic, that just didn't happen. And we had a bit of a sort of festival run, but it was kind of subdued because literally about half of the festivals that we submitted to either canceled or went online. And we stupidly, at the first few festivals we got into, we were like, oh, we don't want to do the whole online thing, you know, because what's the point? Like, the whole point of being at a festival is being there. And so we pulled out of those festivals, and then later on we started seeing that all of them were doing it. And we were like, okay, well, if we want to do any festivals, we have to embrace this whole virtual thing. So it's been a long road, like getting it out there, but we're glad it finally is.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, that's interesting because you're right. It's been an adjustment for everyone. I'm usually covering a festival remotely anyway.
Yeah,
but it's been very interesting to see, like, when the entire fest goes remote, how all of those little, like, the private conversations and inside jokes and all those things that, you know, normally happen in face-to-face, it all, you know, it kind of becomes very, very public with social media and stuff. So it's been a really interesting transition.
Yeah, no, we've definitely ran into that a little bit as well, which has just been kind of interesting. And you know, like you said, everything now online, if it goes online for 10 seconds, it's living online forever, right? You know, someone saved a copy of it somewhere. So we sort of ran into that when we did one festival. I can't remember which one it was, but like the movie got like ripped, and then it ended up on some like Russian website, and then it was just like a nightmare trying to get it like taken down. And it's all new. I mean, those are the kind of things you would never usually run into with festivals if you were doing in-person screenings, but I guess we're all learning together at the same time, so it's all good.
Yeah, that's right. And the first couple just canceled outright, and I mean, if all of them had followed suit, I think that would have been a real bummer. It would have made the last year really suck. So,
we were really holding out for Fantastic Fest. That was the one that we like wanted to sort of, you know, like really like premiere at. I think we missed the deadline for South By, and then so we were sort of waiting, and then we were like, oh, great. You know, like they messaged us and said, hey, like you guys have been shortlisted, you know, like we hope to make the announcement soon. And then they canceled that. And at that point, when Fantastic Fest canceled, we were like, oh man, like, you know, what other festivals are there like on the horizon? I mean, there's Sundance, but we're never going to get into Sundance, you know, just with a title like Snake Dick, it's just not going to happen. So we seriously like considered just shelving it and saying, all right, let's just make 2021 our festival run. But sort of knowing that we had some feature aspirations, we were like, well, you know, then that means we're not going to be able to even shop the feature around probably until after the festival run. So we just said, you know what, let's just get it out there. And Alta came along and asked to buy the short. So it all worked out perfectly in terms of, you know, everything aligning when it needed to.
Well, that's good. So did you, I'm curious then, did you have the idea for the feature already, and you decided to make this short? I guess, how did this come about?
So yeah, so basically the idea for this originally came around the time that sort of Donald Trump announced that he was running for president. So back in 2016. And I think that, you know, one of the only sort of silver linings to come out of his election was that it galvanized, you know, the Me Too movement. And, you know, around that time also, you had the whole Harvey Weinstein scandal coming out and, you know, everything else. And sort of that was just such a sort of prevalent topic. You couldn't really sort of escape it in any way. And, you know, it just got me sort of thinking, you know, a lot, not only about that as an idea, but also the previous election. And obviously, you know, like right now, it's pretty well documented. You know, this country still has a very big problem with racism. But I think it has an even bigger problem with sexism, and always has. And that was another aspect that I just sort of found fascinating is, you know, would Donald Trump have won had he not been running against a woman? And so, you know, that sort of just got the ideas percolating. And then in terms of the concept of, you know, of a woman who had this sort of, you know, phallic-like object as a weapon, that really came from a conversation that I had with my wife many years ago. And we were talking about travel and, you know, what makes it easier for men to travel alone than women. And she said something that, you know, just really stuck with me. It's an obvious statement, but the way that she said it in the context, it was very powerful. And she said, you know, the main reason is that, you know, you have something between your legs that I don't, and it's called freedom. And I thought that's so true. You know, it is so much easier for men to just, you know, take off into the wilderness and you know, go on the road unaccompanied. And I guess sort of adding that to my love of road movies and trashy 80s cinema, you know, naturally what came out of the other end was Snake Dick.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. And it's interesting. So there's a couple of ways to kind of tackle that. Because I think back to the sort of the mid-2000s era in horror, and even further back when you think to like 80s horror, and even 90s horror, and how each of these things kind of has their own distinctive tone and personality. And it's very much sort of, you know, kind of in response to what's going on in the world. You know, there was like with the 2000s, you know, when we had like this sort of resurgence of torture porn in an era when real torture was, you know, was in the news and had been in the news, like things like Abu Ghraib and, yeah. You know, things that, you know, that the American, you know, security forces and things were doing around the world. And it's very interesting. So I'm really interested to see, you know, and it's already started, I think, the Donald Trump era has already kind of moved the meter and shifted and influenced the kinds of horror movies that have been coming out for the last, you know, 18 months or so, and that are going to sort of continue to come out.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that's a very astute observation. And I mean, you look at a movie like Get Out, which I loved, you know, and I think that, you know, they say the best art comes from trauma. And, you know, I think that one of the reasons why, you know, Get Out resonated so much was that, you know, race was back in the equation again, because, you know, how can it not be when you have an openly racist president, right? And I think that, you know, really sort of going back to what I was saying earlier about with Donald Trump, what was so bizarre to me about that was, you know, this is almost sort of like Mr. Misogyny personified. And, you know, he became president of a company of a country that basically pioneered women's rights, you know, all while belittling women, most notably his opponent, on a daily basis, you know, tapes coming out of him admitting to sexual assault. And yet he still won. And, you know, I think that what we saw really with the Me Too movement was just this massive pushback against that. And now that he's sort of out of office, I don't see that pushback going away. I think that there was such a momentum that was created with that. I think that, you know, similar to the fact you had this sort of slew of, you know, war movies that came, you know, years after Vietnam, I think that the political spectrum has weaved its way into art and especially filmmaking for the foreseeable future. And, you know, what I'm sort of fascinated and excited about is ways that can be used and interpreted beyond the literal. And in many ways, sort of, you know, Snake Dick is that for me, at least, you know, I sort of really wanted to approach this as a sort of metaphorical manifestation of male fear towards female empowerment. And, you know, I'm very excited to see what other filmmakers are going to do with those similar themes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there was a phrase that came out during the election, and it was in particular after the Access Hollywood tapes leaked. You know, and that phrase was locker room talk, right? And we've all heard that phrase. And it's one of those things that you do kind of pick up on, even in the short, is, you know, sort of the toxic, not just toxic masculinity, but toxic male sexuality, even. You know, even from things that are, you know, as seemingly innocuous as catcalling and things like that, which are in themselves harmful. You know, we've all, even as men, like we've all experienced it, even if we're not necessarily perpetrators of it, we've all witnessed it. We've all seen it. And in a lot of cases, you know, we don't do anything or say anything about it. You know, nobody comes up to say, hey, you shouldn't talk about someone that way. Like, we just, as guys, like, we don't do that. There's like this sort of unwritten guy code. And that just sort of perpetuates the normalization of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the question that I sometimes get asked is, you know, like, why as a man, you know, did you make this film, and, you know, sort of what qualifies you to speak on behalf of women? And I sort of, you know, just really want to point out, you know, I'm not speaking on behalf of women. You know, this is me more speaking on behalf of men and the toxic masculinity that is, you know, an ever pervasive element in the modern world. And, you know, I don't believe that feminism is a single gender subscription. You know, the same way that Black Lives Matter shouldn't be the burden of a single race, right? You need multiple voices. You need at least two sides pushing against the middle to cultivate any change. So, you know, I also feel that sort of today as well, with this sort of very overtly sort of PC society that we live in, you know, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, I think it's also important that we do sort of really focus on what the story is being told rather than the person who's telling it. And, you know, I look to a lot of my own heroes and mentors and people that I admire as prime examples of that. You know, like Ang Lee, for example, is one of my favorite directors. You know, last time I checked, he wasn't a gay cowboy from the Midwest, you know, but he made a fantastic film about them. And the same with, you know, one of my biggest filmmaking influences of all time is Catherine Bigelow. You know, I mean, Point Break is about as masculine a movie as you can get. Most of her films are, and they're amazing. So, you know, I think that we tend to, or we have sort of moved recently towards sort of putting people in certain boxes and saying, well, you know, you can't do this because you don't look that way, or you weren't born with, you know, the right body parts to tell this story. And I don't think you create solidarity by keeping issues or people who are different from you at arm's length, especially when it comes to art. So, you know, the more that we can sort of start having these open conversations and you know, calling out ourselves as much as other people and being able to tell stories from that perspective, you know, I feel that's when we're really going to achieve this equality that we're all trying to find.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, and that's a great answer to, you know, a question that, you know, that even I had, and I think that you used the right word there, is use the word conversation, and that's what it has to be, right? In the past, like, when, you know, when we look back on things like, you know, like the rape revenge films of, you know, of the 70s that were, and 80s that were made primarily by men, those weren't products of conversation between an artist, a writer, and an actual woman who have experienced actual trauma. It was just a man and they were just sort of assuming, well, this is what I would do in this situation, so that's, you know, what they'll make with this movie. But I think, you know, whether you're male or female, whether you're black or white, I think as long as you're willing to have that conversation and understand and have the self-awareness to say, okay, I need to listen to this feedback, you know, I think that's the right way to approach it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that as I said, really motivated me with this film was not only conversations with my wife, but, you know, other women as well who told me their stories and things that I've also seen with my own eyes and seen that locker room talk. I used to play soccer semi-professionally and, you know, I mean, literal locker room talk, you know, is about as bad as it gets. And you sometimes sort of brush that off and you think, well, you know, these people are saying these things, but they don't really mean them or they would never act upon them. And then sure enough, you see that those people, you know, not in an extreme degree, but in a degree that is still wrong, you know, often do. And so anything that sort of really sort of allows you to have that conversation and just really contribute to it, what you know, and be honest about the things that you don't know and honest about the things that you can't really represent. I mean, for me, ultimately with this film, it has a very important message, you know, woven into it. I don't think that I would want to make this just as a sort of, you know, oh, it's a cool idea and it's an exploitation movie or whatever else. So those themes are very important to it, but also at the same time, you know, I want it to be entertaining and I do want it to be a genre piece. So it's been interesting sort of finding that balance of, you know, when to really lean into this as a, I guess in some aspects as a piece of propaganda, if you want to call it that, and also just to sort of let it breathe as a fun, you know, Thelma and Louise on acid, you know, road movie.
Let's sort of transition from there and talk about your two main leads, because even in this very brief time that we get with them, we get a lot of you know, insight into their relationship.
Yeah, I mean the two leads fortunately were two actresses who I've worked with previously in Sierra Pond and Poppy Drayton, so I already knew that there was a trust factor there. You know, two ways. You know, they'd obviously worked with me before, but I also knew what they were capable of and really wanted to sort of, you know, give them some material and characters that they could truly make their own. It was interesting because we had this, you know, grand idea, as you always do, that you want to do, you know, multiple rehearsals and get the chemistry right. And the first time they actually met each other was on set, just because of the way that the scheduling worked. I was very concerned about that, just because, you know, I knew that they could, you know, like bounce off one another, but I just wasn't sure, you know, how their personalities would interact. And so I was very relieved when we started doing the first, you know, sort of read through and blocking out the scene a little bit, you know, to just see it come to life, like right from the off. And they deserve tremendous credit for that. But in terms of, you know, performances aside, like as characters, that was really sort of, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because the heart of this is really that, you know, not only do men need to stand in solidarity with women, but as a story, you know, these women have to stand in solidarity with each other. And they can't use this weapon. They can't solve the problem without one another. And, you know, when I was sort of trying to figure out exactly how I wanted to sort of build this world, you know, I don't actually remember specifically how I arrived, you know, on a snake, other than it's obviously, you know, it has some phallic connotations to it. But I think a big part of that was really just what sort of it represents more symbolically. I mean, snakes have always sort of represented, you know, fertility or sort of like this creative light force. And, you know, as they sort of shed their skin, they're really sort of symbolic of rebirth and transformation, and just so many things that we don't really think about when we sort of look at snakes. So many people are afraid of them and have phobias and whatever else. So it was really an interesting exercise to sort of figure out, like, how do we humanize these characters that have something, you know, that is an appendage that isn't human-like, and, you know, does have this sort of fear factor associated with it. And yeah, I literally couldn't have got two better actresses who were able to embody that and just, you know, knew how to be subtle and, you know, just knew how to play the role like, you know, they had months and months of rehearsals, which they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. And, your other two characters, you know, I mean, these guys are really hamming it up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for those guys, I really should have took a lot of influence from the works of Paul Verhoeven, who did RoboCop and Basic Instinct. I mean, you know, he Starship Troopers. He's really sort of someone I admire greatly and watched a lot of as a kid, who was also able to sort of weave these social issues into overtly over the top, you know, ultimately entertaining, you know, like epics and set pieces. And so, you know, I mentioned that reference to Mika and Ross, who were the two actors who played those roles. And they were familiar with that source material. And then, so, you know, they just knew what I was going for off the bat. But also, I think they're the nicest guys in the world, but they always get cast as the villains, and every single time they manage to sort of make it their own. But it was interesting because a lot of that stuff, some of it's in the script, and a lot of it was ad-libbing. And, you know, that just sort of constant barrage. And I remember when we were shooting it, at one point I was thinking to myself, you know, like every single take, they're in the background, and we didn't ADR those lines. They're doing them live as the girls are working on the vehicle. And, you know, obviously editorially, you always think, oh, this is going to bite me in the ass and there's going to be overstepping and whatever else. But I wanted it to be real time as much as possible. I wanted it to really sort of feel like, you know, like a woman would feel being alone at a sort of, you know, gas station in the middle of nowhere at night. And they were just so relentless, but also just, you know, so professional. I mean, I love those guys, and definitely, you know, I want to keep them in the feature in significant roles if possible.
Yeah, and that is, I mean, it's good banter. I mean, it's evil, it's horrible banter, but it's good banter, in that it all feels very naturalistic, and it's not over the top, but it's not really that over the top. You know, there are people like that, and it's one of those things that is, you know, it sort of gets wrapped up in, you know, in male privilege and things like that. Because if I pull into a gas station, you know, and it's dark and I get out and there's people standing around drinking, I'll pretty much be left alone. But you know, a couple of attractive young women, and that's just not going to be the case. And you get this, you get all this unwanted attention.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's something that I've seen myself, and you know, that I think every single woman in the world, unfortunately, has a story about. And we, you know, it's an issue that it's not going to go away tomorrow. But it is an issue that I think finally people are waking up and realizing that if they don't plant those seeds to solving that problem now, then, you know, until we do, it won't ever disappear. But, you know, we are certainly in a place, I feel, that like you said earlier, people aren't as afraid to have the conversation now, and having had that conversation once, they're not afraid to have it twice, and they're not afraid to have it, you know, with the person who is actually doing this, and to really sort of speak up. And I've actually seen that, you know, I've seen with my own eyes in the past sort of 6 months, I've witnessed a couple of occasions where you could guarantee that, you know, 1 or 2 years ago, nobody would have said anything. And you know, I've stepped in, you know, once or twice, and I've witnessed others do it many times. And, you know, I think that's a great thing. You know, I mean, how relevant, you know, that is to, you know, an idea as bizarre as Snake Dick, you know, I don't know. but I do know that the more that we sort of start talking about this, and the more that we start, you know, having these female heroes in these films that we love so much, really be a little bit more layered, and not just be sort of eye candy, you know, the more that they'll get the respect that they deserve. And you know, I go back to people were doing this 30 years ago. I mean, I go back to sort of Sigourney Weaver. I mean, every role that she took in the 80s, you know, she made it her own. And I remember watching her. She was like my idol as a kid, all of her movies. And then, you know, even like Linda Hamilton as Sarah Connor, you know, so like these strong female characters have existed, but you know, it's always, they've always been the exception to the rule. And I think now that it's changing a little bit. And
they're frequently masculinized as they sort of take on the more heroic persona.
Right.
You know, think of, you know, like shaving the head in Aliens. To be powerful as a woman, you have to, you know, look or act like a man. And, you know, and I feel like that trope is also starting, is finally kind of breaking down and wearing away.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
The other sort of theme that's I think is really common is, you know, even when she pulls out the gun and, you know, the guys you know, back off to, you know, sort of an extent that you would expect. But even then, like they still don't really perceive a threat. You know, his friend comes over and he does like kind of the typical, okay, you know, you proved your point. You know, he's sorry, you know, and how many times have we seen this where, you know, somebody gets called on, you know, their sexist bullshit and they're like, yeah, you made your point. I'm sorry. And, you know, I shouldn't have done that. And then, right. You know, 5 minutes later, they're right back to doing the exact same thing again.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. It's been interesting exploring the reaction to that moment as well with Ross when he sort of stands up and intervenes, because on Alta, like one of the things we were not expecting at all to come out of, you know, us displaying the movie on their platform is all these reaction videos. And it's just so funny to me because, you know, people will watch the movie and they'll react to it. And, you know, the reactions have been overwhelmingly positive, which has been awesome. There's a couple that stand out, and there's one where this one guy, I don't even know if I want to give him the sort of airtime and oxygen, but it's just interesting because he can't get past that moment. You know, he can't get past the moment of her pulling the gun on him. And he's like, oh, you know, the minute that you lose your masculinity as a man, you're done. And, you know, I can't watch this, you know, this is too much. And then he like shuts it off. And then another guy, when we get to the moment where Ross sort of stands up, interjects and you know, pulls out the knife, it's like, oh yeah, you know, like he bought his knife to this gunfight, and sort of makes a bit of a joke out of it that, you know, I would put my money on him with the knife than I would, you know, with the girls with the gun. And unknowingly he hit the nail on the head there. I mean, that's exactly why that moment exists, because they don't respect these women even when they have a gun in their face. Not truly. You know, I mean, right. Mika, the pig squealer, he plays along because he doesn't really have much of a choice, but he doesn't really believe that she's going to shoot him. And it's only when he sort of arrives at that place at the end, you know, those tears and that state that he's in aren't because he's fearing for his life. It's because, you know, he's realized his own sort of self-shame. And, you know, the other character, he brings a knife to the gunfight because he too believes that, hey, you know, like that weapon isn't a threat to me. And it's only when he's faced with a weapon that he understands, i.e. a weapon of his own reflection in this snake dick, that, you know, really he starts to pay attention. And, you know, you know, the reaction that he has at the end of the film, I won't ruin it for anyone, but yeah, that's, I'm glad that you sort of brought that up, because that's definitely something that's been and is being discussed, you know, in relation to the film right now. And it's fascinating to see.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting. And, yeah, I think all those themes are sort of, they're, you know, are sort of dancing around there. And it's one of the things that I found, you know, just sort of really fascinating about it is, you know, until he's presented with, you know, the fact that she has, you know, this, you know, phallic anatomy, you know, that's the moment that they finally decide, oh, we should give them respect. And of course it's too late at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The notes have been played, you know.
So, that's fantastic. And I understand you shot this all in one night.
We did. Yeah. It was a hell of a production. But we just had to in the end. Poppy was shooting a TV show, and her schedule only lined up with the location schedule on that night. And I knew I wanted to shoot it at that location, and I was like, there's no way we can shoot this anywhere else. So, and also, you know, we want a big production. You know, we self-financed this and begged, borrowed, and just about drew the line at stealing whatever we needed in order to do it. So we spoke to the location, and the owner over there was really cool. And he was like, look, you know, I want to help you guys out. I like what you're doing, but you're going to have to work around my calendar rather than me work around yours. And we're like, okay, you know, no worries. So that was the date that he gave us, which just happened to be the shortest night of the year. So we were like, oh my God, you know, how are we going to do this? But we had a strict 12 hours. We had a hard in, a hard out. So, you know, we got there, we started rigging everything, and it was already dark. We were already into our darkness, you know, about sort of an hour in. So we were like an hour and a half, maybe. We were like, okay, you know, we gotta get everything ready to go. And then I think before lunch, we'd only popped off, I think, two shots. And, you know, everyone was panicking a little bit. But I was quietly confident that knowing that we had such, you know, great actors, and we'd sort of really sort of established the blocking already, and we were limited to one location, that we could pull it off, as long as, you know, we weren't doing too many takes of everything. And again, like, the actors deserve all the credit. I mean, they made it possible to shoot that movie in one night. And massive shout out as well to my DP, Chris Saul, who, you know, is a super talented guy. I love working with him. We worked together on a bunch of stuff, but, you know, he didn't have a lighting department. I mean, the lighting department was basically, me and him and one other guy. And, we were just sort of running around, just, you know, moving lights constantly. And, you know, neither of us just sat still for a moment. But we got it done. And I think really, like, a lot of people, one of the encouraging things, you know, a lot of people have reached out to us, you know, asking us for behind the scenes photos and how do we do this and how do we do that. And one of the encouraging things has just been really to make people realize that if you plan well enough, and if you have a team of people that are all pulling in the same direction. I mean, we only had a crew, a production crew on set of 12 people, but they were all, you know, busting their ass, doing two, sometimes three jobs. You know, it is possible to shoot a short in one night. I remember we shot right up until the sun started to appear over the horizon, and then it was just a mad scramble to get in the car and get that final drone shot. And then I think I slept for about a month.
Well, that's great. And I mean, you can tell that everyone is busting their ass, because the short looks fantastic. I mean, the lighting and the cinematography is all on point. And it looks really, really professional. So, huge credit to you guys for pulling that off with a small crew. So.
We were very inspired by the works of a great cinematographer, Andrew Laszlo, who shot The Warriors and Streets of Fire. Mm. And, you know, he was one of the first sort of cinematographers, you know, back in the day who was using these practical lights as actual sort of sources. Cronenworth was doing it a little bit with Blade Runner, but back in those days when they were shooting on film, you just needed so much more light. And now with digital sensors, you know, you don't. But we still sort of wanted to embrace those principles that, you know, The Warriors had as a sort of visual aesthetic. And, you know, again, very inspired by sort of Catherine Bigelow, you know, the look of John Carpenter's movies. You know, they always had that sort of, like, interesting, like, a lot of them had that neon vibe. You know, just wanted the camera work to be intuitive and responsive as well. So, you know, I operated a lot of the shots myself, just so I could be close to the actors, not restrict them to whatever we'd sort of previously rehearsed. And the vivid colors was something that we felt would really sort of help make it feel futuristic, but also timeless. And the intention there was really to be able to evoke a world that seemed both new and familiar while sort of weaving in its own subtext. So, you know, very, very fortunate and lucky to have fantastic collaborators to achieve that. And obviously delighted with the response that it's been getting.
Yeah, that's awesome. One of my favorite things about it, honestly, is the lighting. I guess, talk to me a little bit about Alter. I mean, I know they're part of Gunpowder and Sky.
I mean, they've been awesome, you know, from the get-go. They reached out after we played at Holly Shorts. There was a category there that was presented by Dust, which is their other platform, sci-fi platform. I think that's the one that made the movie Prospect. That was sort of a Dust Gunpowder production. And the Alter is more their sort of horror, and Dust is more sci-fi. And we were a little sort of curious at first, like, would we be put in the horror category or are we in the sci-fi? I mean, I sort of see Snake Dick more as a sci-fi thriller than I do as a horror. But the Alter community, it's so diverse and it has so many movies in there that also kind of fit into that category where they're almost horror or they're like extreme thrillers. And I really respect just so many of the films that are in there, some of which, you know, I saw on the festival circuit. They have this one movie, Stucco, which is, you know, amazing and has like blown up everywhere. I think they're doing a feature version of that or the filmmakers are developing it. So I just thought we'd be in really good company. And the process has been amazing. I mean, the guys over there are awesome, very supportive, and also very passionate as well. I've certainly come across platforms in the past where there's a bit of a disconnect between, you know, the content makers and the content distributors, in the sense that they don't really get what they're buying and what they're putting out there. They just know that other people think it's cool and therefore they want it. Whereas with Alter, you know, just in every piece of communication, you can just tell that you're dealing with people who really love genre and really love the material that they're promoting. So that's been a refreshingly awesome experience. And we're developing a feature version, and we're literally like getting ready to take it out in the next couple of weeks and finally done with the script. Our first stop will probably be the guys at Gunpowder and Sky, because they've just been so awesome to deal with.
That's really awesome. That's exciting. And I think I can see, you know, by the way that it's shot and the way that it's lit, that it has that sort of sci-fi feel to it. But I think, you know, because it's a part of her body, I think that for a lot of people that sort of automatically, you know, kind of goes into the horror category. But definitely it's there's not a bright line anymore, between genres as much as, you know, some people want to try and draw one.
Everything's a mashup these days, isn't it? It's just where we're
it's where we are, but it makes things fun. And a lot of people will tell you, like, I'm in a lot of filmmaking groups on Facebook and things like that. And, one of the pieces of advice that gets thrown around a lot is, you know, if you're making a short, like, don't make a short thinking that you're going to sell your short, because nobody buys shorts. That's what everyone says. And so it's really cool to see, a distributor outlet really opening up a marketplace to say, no, we'll buy your shorts. And it's still much smaller than the marketplace for buying features. So you probably should still not necessarily expect to sell your short, or that shouldn't be maybe your plan A. But I think it's something that could happen now. So that's exciting.
Yeah, and I think that, you look at sort of, I think people got a little frightened with the whole Quibi thing, right? You know, when you had this massive, failure. But that was just so ambitious in scale. And the reality is that they weren't really, I mean, there were some sort of independent filmmakers that were on there, but I mean, they were doing sort of some pretty big ticket stuff with very well-known directors. and you know, almost just doing short form versions of studio level movies. And I don't think that people want to see those in that kind of format. Or if they do, they're not quite ready for it. I think that what's interesting about these other platforms is that the ideas, because a lot of them are self-financed, and because a lot of them are just, you know, labors of love and passion projects, there aren't really any rules or limitations. And I guess ultimately censorship. Nobody is giving them notes. You know, nobody came to me and said, "Hey, you know, like snake dick's cool and all, but you know, what if you made, you know, the snake a giraffe?" You know, like, I mean, it's like I feel like with these smaller platforms like Crypt TV, Alta, you know, Omeletto, they're great because you're getting these stories really sort of from the source, you know, unfiltered. And I really hope that continues. And I also think as well that the short film market, you know, now that the standard is rising so much, I do feel that there are a lot of opportunities, you know, not just for sort of cross-pollination in terms of, you know, like finding filmmakers in the short film world and then transitioning them into features. But I think just the way that people are consuming content now, you know, more people are watching YouTube than anything else. And people are watching stuff on their phone. So the sort of the audience was there for Quibi. I just don't think that they capitalized on those audience needs. And I'm super curious to see what outlets like Alta and as I said, Crypt, that have already established themselves and have millions and millions of subscribers. I think, you know, Alta has like 1.6, 1.7 million subscribers now. I know Crypt TV has about 3 or 4 million, maybe even more. You know, that's a really strong foothold. And I think that's exciting for, you know, short filmmakers everywhere who want to get involved.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Quibi had an interesting concept, but they had a disconnect between who their audience was and how their audience, you know, prefers to consume their media, because like the people that want to watch, you know, high production value, you know, dramatic or genre content on, you know, on Netflix or things like that, they're just fine watching an episode of a show in 5 or 10 minute chunks when they go to the bathroom or when they're on the train or something. Yeah. Like they don't need it broken up for them. And the audience that is watching these sort of super short form content, like things like TikToks and stuff, you know, they're not there for production value. They're looking for, you know, creativity and authentic content and, you know, which are not things that you get, you know, from a studio production necessarily. So it was one of those things where it was, you know, it was chocolate and peanut butter, but it just didn't work out the way chocolate and peanut butter work out.
Yeah. I also think as well that it really, one thing that Quibi would have done well to understand is the modern attention span, and sort of everybody is accused of, you know, that we're the sort of ADD generation. There's just so many options at our disposal. How can we possibly sit still? But we do sit still. And I think that, you know, Netflix and their metrics, you know, proved it, that people will binge watch shows, you know, they will binge it until there's no more left. And then, you know, they wait another year until, you know, the new season comes out. And, you know, I'm the same. I mean, even like before quarantine, if there's a great show and I watch the pilot and I absolutely love it, like I'm trying my hardest to clear my schedule so that I can finish it like there and then, because, you know, I just can't wait. And I think that, you know, when you have someone's attention, you've got to capitalize on it. And with Quibi, with that whole sort of idea of, well, you know, they're in like different chunks, and suddenly it requires so much effort to, you know, log back in, or, you know, like open your app and watch this one episode, and yeah, I'll watch this one later. And, you know, you have to do that, you know, 10 or 12 times to get through a season, and all for something that is ultimately, you know, the overall length of like a short feature. And so, you know, I feel that like they needed sort of something in their model that would allow them to sort of capitalize on people's attention and just sort of keep watching. And if you want to watch more, and if you don't want to watch something in 10-minute increments, that you had the option to watch it as one sort of finished coherent piece, then I think, you know, there might have been a little bit more uptake. Because even I found myself on that platform, you know, on the sort of few experiences that I tried to watch their content, I just found myself thinking, well, you know, I'm, most of what I'm seeing here is credits, you know, like there's not enough meat on this bone. And if they had given me the option to sort of watch some of these shows from start to finish, I probably would have in one sort of uninterrupted sitting, and then I would have come back and watched something else. And I think that's a lesson that can be learned, you know, moving forward for these platforms.
Right, right. Yeah. And even when you think back to, you know, the ancient old days of serialized television, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, at least there you got 20 minutes of content. You know, so you felt like you got your money's worth, and okay, now I'll wait till next week. At some point it just becomes tedious.
I'm not going to set my reminders for a 5-minute show, that's for sure.
So David, I have just one more question or one more topic to get to, because I asked the question somewhat rhetorically last week on the podcast, and that question was, do snakes have dicks? Because I don't really know much about, you know, reptilian anatomy. So I don't know. I'm just curious, like, has this ever come up in conversation? Have you Googled this?
Well, it hasn't just crossed my mind. It's been, it's definitely been explored, more than I would care to admit. There've been some interesting Google image searches, but yes, they do. And they don't have, one, dick, they have two dicks. And they're called hemipenis, and it literally means, you know, two penises. And it's pretty disgusting. So if you don't want to see what I'm talking about, don't type it into Google.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, and yes, that is the answer. And it's fascinating. The other fascinating fun fact that I learned is that just as people are either left or right-handed, snakes will appear to favor one penis versus the other.
Now that I did not know, and that is extremely disturbing.
And just to think about that, our good men and women of science are using that time and the money that they raise to, you know, to watch snakes fuck. Because how else would you obtain this knowledge?
Right. Yeah, I'm just trying to think, like, now, like, you know, yeah, that's, I'm trying to think if I had the same problem, like, how would I decide? I mean, I guess it's a good problem to have.
The other interesting thing is that each dick has its own corresponding testicle. So they can, if they choose,
oh, that would make sense. Yeah.
Yeah. They can impregnate two snakes, in a short period of time. If they so choose and the opportunity presents itself. So,
Okay. Yeah.
Fascinating stuff about snake anatomy. This is an educational podcast.
I actually did not know that. And that has kind of blown my mind a little bit. So thank you. I thought I knew everything I could possibly know about snake dicks. And there you are. You proved I don't.
So, well, there you go. All right. So David Mamoudier, writer and director of Snake Dick. David, where is there anywhere online where people can sort of keep up with you and, you know, find out about, you know, when what, you know, what's happening with the Snake Dick feature and, you know, any other projects you're working on?
Yeah, absolutely. My personal Instagram is Darvood, D-A-R-V-O-O-D, which is my that's my name in Farsi, and I'm actually Iranian. They can find the project Snake Dick at www.snakedick.com, or we have Instagram Snake Dick Movie, I believe. So any of those.
All right, fantastic. Thank you so much, and thanks everyone out there also for listening. Once again, I've been your host, Patrick Anderson. You can find me, follow me on Twitter @FinHorror or @NSFAPod. feel free to email the show at notsuitablepod@gmail.com or go look us up on Anchor, anchor.fm/NSFAPod, and you can click through there to send me an audio message. David Erthson, I really appreciate your time this evening, and I wish you the best of luck, and definitely looking forward to getting some more snake dick.
Awesome. We'll keep it coming.
All right. Please, yeah, keep the snake dick coming.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you.